Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for March 30th, 2009, and on this week's episode, we have an interview with Kevin Cox from Playing with Fire at Boho Theater. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, and let's talk theater.
This is the Talk Theater in Chicago interview podcast. I'm your host, Ann Nicholson Weber, and today I'm talking to Kevin Cox, who is starring in a production of Playing with Fire by Barbara Fields at Boho Theater, which is a version adaptation of the Frankenstein story. And Kevin's character is the monster, or in this case called the creature. I think it's a terrific performance and wanted to talk to him about it. So welcome, Kevin.
Thank you very much, Anne.
I think one of the most impressive and moving aspects of your performance relates to the movement in the voice. And I thought it would be interesting for you to talk a little bit about how you created your characterization, very, very different from kind of the cliched version of the monster that we have. So maybe you could just dive into how you begin creating a way of moving as a character.
Sure, sure. Yes, thank you. Well, absolutely. There was a sense of, from when we began, and you know, the casting took place, and I became aware that I would be playing this iconic character. At first, of course, there's this excitement. Terrific, I'm playing an iconic character. And then, of course, there's the fear that follows of, oh, I'm playing an iconic character, right, and I have to live up to that.
Everybody's got an idea about it.
Right, uh-huh. A preconceived notion of, mm-hmm, of what they're expecting. And mm-hmm, I am not 9 feet tall. I'm and green and bolts in the neck. So I've got to figure out a way to take my, you know, my physical instrument and bring something with that. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, it was really just a matter of, for myself, washing away all of those preconceived notions and starting from scratch. And even though I had just finished reading the novel, really had to have a clean slate there.
Is there anything in the novel that describes the way the creature moves?
There, as far as movement, there isn't a lot at all. Mm-hmm. There is substantial information about what he looks like. Mm-hmm. He is a tall, lumbering, large beast, mm-hmm, that's frightening, you know, villagers and whatnot. But there isn't a whole lot about movement, which was a whole other thing. Mm-hmm. So it really came down to, you know, the considerations were, I guess, in three main parts. How is he made? Mm-hmm. How did Frankenstein construct the creature? Out of what pieces? And with what elements, whether it be chemicals or electricity, and obviously that's involved. Mm-hmm. But what's inside of him? Are they all human bones? Mm-hmm. Or are there animal parts inside of him? Which is an idea that I really got excited about. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely brought up in the novel, maybe once or twice. But the idea of him, you know, digging up animals and people and just kind of throwing all this together and hoping that it looks and acts like something was really exciting. And then the second part is his nurture. How does his upbringing and his early life affect what he looks like and how he moves, both physically and kind of metaphorically? There was a sense of he's been beaten down by society. Mm-hmm. The first time he entered the society of men, he says, I wandered into a village, and the children screamed, and women are fainting, and men are throwing sticks and stones and cudgels. So there's this sense of society beating him down, mm-hmm, into this physicality that is sort of defensive, you know, mm-hmm, rather than on the attack all the time.
Yeah, it's very, there's definitely a cringing quality, I would say, to the way you move. Mm-hmm. I hadn't ever articulated that, but I can I now see it that way as you describe, you know, that part of what went into your recipe.
Sure, yeah. Well, there's a lot of fear in him, and there's a lot of reason for that, because he's never really experienced kindness.
Right. So, and then there was maybe a third, or what?
Oh, yes. And then finally, it really, for me, in my mind, was an aesthetic. What is this going to look like?
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, can we do it for the length of a run?
Right, without a chiropractic appointment every day.
And he's on stage for the first full act as well, so there's no breaks there.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
But there was definitely a concern of kind of a personal hesitation almost. Of, as an actor, I was like, you know, is this going to look weird? And there was a lot of getting over those humps and knocking down those obstacles of my own fears about, you know, looking goofy on stage. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it took me a little while to just say, you know what, I gotta let that go and live in this story and create my own creature. And of course, Adam Kander, as the younger creature, he and I
Before you go any further, sure. We need to explain that a little bit. There's a very interesting device in the play where there are two versions of you.
Yes.
Your present self and essentially a flashback self, right?
Right.
An earlier, younger version of the creature, played by another actor, and you're often both on stage at the same time.
Right.
Okay, so now...
So Adam Kander and I both have a lot of work to do there to meet mm-hmm. at a place where we are both happy with our creature.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a lot of... It was nice. It was a lot of just watching one another
mm-hmm.
and feeding off of each other and, you know, taking bits and pieces and elements, just like Frankenstein, to assemble a final product where we meet
Very
at
matched.
A unified
mm-hmm.
vision.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. So when I look at what I consider to be your characterization, it was created at least partly by Adam, you're saying.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Absolutely.
Can you characterize at all what the differences were? I mean, at the moment when you and Adam both came into rehearsal, with your version of this character, his was, give me an adjective, and yours was, give me another adjective.
His was very thoughtful, and had his version, he early on had a great grasp of the humanity of the creature.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the part that took me a while to get a hold of. And I felt I had a stronger grasp on its beastliness mm-hmm. and the anger mm-hmm. and the fear mm-hmm. and some of the darker qualities that he had,
mm-hmm.
which was great. I mean, this worked out so well that the two actors with different strengths were able to help one another
yeah.
find our way to a whole three-dimensional being.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Marston Sullivan, our director, he would often say, you know, Adam is doing this thing that I really like, and I'd like to see a little bit more of that in you, if you could throw some of that in,
mm-hmm.
and vice versa. And
right, right.
So it was very, very interesting and exciting process to work that way.
Yeah, that's kind of unprecedented, I would
right.
think. I'm trying to think, when would that ever come up, that kind of process? That's very interesting. Well, maybe that has something to do with the... really poetic success of it, in my mind. We'll go back to, you said something, let me see if I can remember now. Oh, the fear of being goofy. In the end, isn't it okay to say, how does this look, and I don't want it to look goofy because that's not the effect I want to have? Or as an actor, do you think it's important to just not think about that?
Well, I think the most important thing at the end of the day is just to say forget about it and dive in with 100% commitment.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know for myself, when I give any less, that's when I don't believe myself. And if mm-hmm. I don't believe myself, how can I ask anyone to believe me?
Right.
What I'm saying, what I'm doing. I have to believe what I'm saying 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And once I realize that and reminded myself of that
mm-hmm.
more so, I just said the hell with it, and I'm just going to walk out there and physically be very, very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But I know that that is what this calls for,
mm-hmm.
and that's what needs to happen here.
So talk about that. Do you have to have chiropractic or massage therapy? I mean, you're just so kind of twisted. It's hard to describe exactly, but you're very seldom in a healthy posture in the entire performance. Let's just say that.
Well, we do a great deal of stretching before the show.
Mm-hmm.
And really comes down to having a good warm-up. And for myself, I've learned the importance of taking care of my body,
mm-hmm.
you know, sleeping and eating right. And that really makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly have to drink a great deal of water because there's a disgusting amount of sweating going on in my part.
Uh-huh. I know that there's a wonderful book by Sir Anthony Sher, called The Year of the King, which is an autobiographical book describing his year leading up to first getting the part and then rehearsing the part of Richard III. And this was a big concern for him, how he was going to do a run of a play contorting his body so fantastically, as mm-hmm. he ended up doing. In fact, I think he did negotiate for either massage therapy or chiropractic as part of his contract with the Royal Shakespeare
Society. Giving me ideas.
Yeah, right. But I have to imagine that there is a danger of really injuring yourself. Is there anything that you kind of did proactively in designing the creature, or did you just do whatever poetically you felt was necessary and hoped that your body would withstand it?
B. Yeah. Uh-huh. And so far it's going better than I thought, uh-huh. Vocally and physically.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that vocally since we're there. Can you do even just a few lines in the voice that you use?
Sure, that'd be great. The first time I saw the moon rise, I was alone in a wood and afraid. When I saw it sail up into the sky, I yelled and flung myself on the ground in a frenzy of joy. As long as there was light in the sky, I was not alone. The worst thing is to be alone.
Ooh, that was great. It is great. As a singer, though, it really does make me worry for your vocal health as well as your spinal health and everything else. Again, has your voice held up? Has this been a problem?
It hasn't been a problem. I really thought that it would be, but it hasn't been.
Yeah.
I'm sure that it makes a big difference that I quit smoking a couple months ago.
Uh-huh,
back
good for
in
you.
November. Thank uh-huh. you. Which goes back to, you know, if you take care of yourself, it really, you know,
makes a difference.
It makes a huge difference.
You stay healthier.
Absolutely. And your body can do more things.
Mm-hmm.
It's a flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
So after doing that, I kind of feel great.
Yeah. Well, talk about, again, the imagination of that voice. What were you trying to say with the growliness, for instance? Did that come from a mechanical imagination of how his vocal tract is constructed, or was it an expressing a particular aspect of a... Yeah, just tell me what you can about that.
Sure. There's a lot to be said for our discussions in how he was constructed and what about him maybe doesn't work so well.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's a hole in his lungs or something.
Mm-hmm.
These are all faulty, you know, it's filth that Frankenstein has dug up. So there's those physical things to consider, and then sort of metaphorically going back to, I needed something to match and complement the movement,
mm-hmm.
that defensive quality, the fear. So there's
yeah.
a gruffness, which is a protective, you know, it shields him. It's
mm-hmm.
it's harsh, and it protects him in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are moments in the play when he lets his guard down a little bit, and the voice kind of changes slightly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that Peter, thankfully, really pushed me to do, because mm-hmm. with a vocal quality like that, it makes it a little bit more difficult to bring out the humanity, to let that shine through
mm-hmm.
all of that gruff, protective.
Growly, almost. But also the lungs, the breathing, kind of labored breath,
mm-hmm.
definitely hear in that.
Right. That is, just doing it on an inhalation. Everyone is, you know, it's crazy. Adam can do it as well. And mm-hmm. it's one of those just stupid human tricks that works. And,
right.
And my voice is already, you know, it's all the way down here.
Right.
So I need to use that, especially in a role like this, to my advantage.
Right, you know, right.
And see how far I can take it, you know, its elasticity while being healthy.
There's another thing that I thought was interesting about the movement, because while you are contorted, you're actually rather graceful. Do you recognize that at all?
I did. That was part of the consideration, only in that he has made it quite far through life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a survivalist quality to him where he's figured out how to live on his own in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And also hunt for himself.
Yeah.
There's a lot of these.
It's effective. He's learned how to move effectively.
Right.
In some ways, awkwardly.
And in the older creature, it was, you know, there's this much more stillness to him than in the younger creature. But mm-hmm. at certain moments, he can
move
lash
fast,
out and
yeah.
move very quickly.
Yeah. He's very agile, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing you mentioned before the interview was that at least you spent one rehearsal on a particular theory or technique of movement. Is that right?
Yes, we did. Peter led us one rehearsal, very, very important, helpful rehearsal, in the work of Rudolf Laban. And these are movement principles that help us determine how we are communicating that language through movement. And some examples of these actions are punch, slash, press, glide, and ring, and float. And then from there you determine the space and the time and the weight of these actions.
Hmm.
And we all brought in various pieces of music that we felt kind of spoke to our characters and might assist us in this.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just sort of played. You know, it was Buck, Zachary, Frankenstein, myself, and Adam Kander as the younger creature. And we spent about an hour playing around with the music and the movement language and just a forum for us as individual actors to explore those things and to get rid of our inhibitions mm-hmm. and just find things on our own, which was enormously helpful. Mm-hmm. I found myself, I know I found a lot there.
Try to describe the process in a little more
sure,
detail.
Sure, absolutely. Each of us chose three of those actions mm-hmm. that we felt were best appropriate for our character.
Mm-hmm.
And I chose slash, press, and flick.
Hmm.
Those spoke to me. Flick, there was an electricity about it
mm-hmm.
that harkened back to his beginning. The slashing was his defensive moves mm-hmm. when he's being attacked,
mm-hmm.
whether it's his emotions or physical person, and then press, and that is his will to keep going
mm-hmm.
and to live and to get answers to the questions he needs from his creator.
Hmm. So then you would actually do those actions and begin to just feel how you would incorporate them into your vocabulary. Is that right?
Right. It's just a matter of how that speaks to you and how you can manifest that
hmm.
in your own person
mm-hmm.
and what it means for the creature to, you know, given all of the other information and stimuli that we have for the construction of the character, how does that push it forward and sort of color in the lines?
Mm-hmm. That sounds really interesting. What music did you bring in?
I brought in a couple things that most importantly, though, it was a sort of industrial rock, heavy metal, that really kind of, it was Tool, actually.
Uh-huh.
And that's sort of an alternative rock, but they have this great grimy metal sound that kind of, it's also strange, and it got me out of my head.
Uh-huh.
And it allowed me to kind of move in that gruesome fashion, and you know, it often can be sort of disgusting as well.
Uh-huh.
It's not beautiful.
The music, yeah.
Right,
mm-hmm,
right.
Mm-hmm, right. It would be interesting, I think, to talk a little bit about the space. This teeny, tiny, I think someone, one of the reviewers described it as a Kleenex box space, and that's a good description. Very narrow. You're right up against the walls on both sides of the stage. You know, there are no wings. There's no space. What does that do to your options as a performer?
It does a lot. It has a huge impact. It's a great pleasure, and it's also a great challenge in that every glint in your eye is going to say something, mm-hmm. and it forces you to be present 100% of the time.
For the 12 people in the audience.
Right.
What is it, a 25-seat house?
A 28, I believe, is the capacity. Mm-hmm. And they see everything.
Yeah, you know, it's almost like film work.
You can't hide a thing in there, and it gives you this opportunity that I took great delight in with this character, creating all this movement stuff, because I knew it was not for naught. Every little thing would be seen. Every mm-hmm. flicker of a finger would carry mm-hmm. and transmit. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of thought that went into how the movement communicates and what the movement communicates. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to, you know, just as it does in life, as on the stage, our movement says something, our body language. And we kind of had to strip that away and find how this creature moves differently, and how is that discernible from human movement, and what are the different things that his body posture says. Mm-hmm. And from that I myself was drawing information from animals.
I was just going to ask that. Yeah. Did you explain what you did? What was your process?
Well, I definitely considered the fact that he was constructed of various different species, which gave me so much more to play with, think that he maybe has, even if it's just blood or some DNA of animals, it's in there, and it affects how he thinks and how he moves and how he reacts.
So were you observing animals? Were you watching YouTubes of how a dog expresses emotion, or what were you doing with that?
I'm certainly picking up things from my cat, absolutely. Uh-huh. But then it's also just sort of imagining what animal is the creature, or what animals are maybe in the creature? Mm-hmm. Are they lizards? There's something, you know, there's griminess about him and how it kind of slinks around. And also the hunting, mm-hmm. you know, there's a definite cat instincts mm-hmm. there. You want some of that in there. Mm-hmm. And then the cowering and the fear. Can kind of look at you know, really anything, but mm-hmm. you know, a dog, how its body posture communicates so much.
Right.
So you have these great examples of things to soak in and absorb and kind of mix and mash, and hope that whatever language of movement you come up with does communicate the things that you want to convey.
Well, going back to the smallness of the space, I think that is one of the pleasures for the audience, is these tiny little adjustments of expression or posture that can be viewed, because, you know, whatever you are, 6 feet away or something. Mm-hmm. It's very delicate work, actually, which is not always true of the stage.
Right. You know, sometimes it's a much broader brushstroke. Mm-hmm. And in there, it's a lot of very tiny detail work.
Very fine.
Which is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I enjoy that.
Right. Well, that leads to something else in my mind for some reason, which was striking about the writing and the way you embodied it, which is that this creature is actually extremely articulate. You've got a lot to say and a lot that must take just the kind of work you would take on Shakespeare is putting it too high, but it's not easy language to own, I would think.
Absolutely. There is a heightened quality to a lot of the language, and the creature is highly evolved. He's done a great deal of reading.
In the Sorbonne, no less.
In the Sorbonne. With plenty of time on his hands. Uh-huh. Paradise Lost is his favorite novel. Uh-huh. The modern Prometheus. But yes, he is highly evolved, and to Frankenstein's surprise, I think, which gives the, you know, it's one of the pieces that gives the play a place to go. Frankenstein is so interested in how this came to be. Mm-hmm. There's so much more to learn that he...
About his own creation.
About his own creation, yeah, that he had no idea, yeah, of.
Are you classically trained?
No, I wouldn't say that I'm classically trained. Mm-hmm. I have a BFA in acting from Millikan University.
Mm-hmm. And then you came here straight from there? Or...
Yes, I did.
And have been acting in Chicago for how long?
Well, I took about a year and a half off, mm-hmm, after graduating in 2003. Mm-hmm. And then got very serious. It was actually a production at the Goodman, King Lear.
Oh, yeah.
I went and saw that, and it was, I left with this overwhelming drive and need to get moving. Uh-huh. And that was a big moment for me. Going to the Goodman and seeing that show, I felt like a child again. There were so many elements of that production that I was wondering, how are they doing that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I had that childlike wonder and uh-huh, kind of fell in love with theater again after taking a little break. And since then, I've been very, very fortunate to be quite active.
Mm-hmm. You, not too long ago, you understudied in Sean Graney's Edward II at Chicago Shakes.
Yes, I did.
So obviously you have some kind of facility with Shakespeare, at least somebody thinks you do, which I can totally see in the way you did into this production. Is that something that you aspire to?
It is, absolutely. Uh-huh. Absolutely. I really, really enjoy working on Shakespeare, and I took a class with Jeffrey Carlson at Chicago Shakes recently.
Who played Edward II in that production.
Right, and it was absolutely invaluable. Hmm. And every time I go to an audition at Chicago Shakes or elsewhere, I love taking that knowledge with me. I feel so much better going into auditions after having that class.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like there's anything you've learned doing this role that's changed who you are as an actor?
I think so, absolutely. This is definitely a role. I haven't gone this far physically. I haven't, not to stick a feather in my hat, but I'm working very, very very, very hard up there.
Yeah.
And you get to know your limits. You mm-hmm. get to know where you can push yourself to. But you also learn about where your strengths and weaknesses are. I recognize that one of the hardest things about this role for me was to bring a real humanity to this creature. Mm-hmm. There were so many elements about him that I understood and could relate with so well. As I mentioned earlier, sort of the harshness of him and the anger, mm-hmm. which is a quality that I can relate to, and I don't, it's not too difficult for me to get there.
Right, right.
But it's the vulnerability that Peter really pulled out of me, mm-hmm. and we were able to bring to the surface, and mm-hmm. I learned a lot about why that's difficult for me, mm-hmm. and how good it feels to find it, mm-hmm. and to let it out, and to feel that humanity in a character like this.
How does a director do that, or how did Peter do it in your case?
It was partly vocally. Mm-hmm. As I said before, it was the sound quality of the voice makes for a very sort of rough being, mm-hmm. and it's hard to see the humanity through all of that. Mm-hmm. But he helped me find moments in the play where it was appropriate, where he felt that we really needed, it was a great place, an opportunity to see the humanness, mm-hmm. the humanity of mm-hmm. the creature, mm-hmm. and just kept pushing me.
So is it as simple as saying, you know, right there, Kevin, be more vulnerable?
I don't know if he ever used that word. I'm sure that we did, absolutely. But it's a matter of, you know, we need to see his guard down a little bit, mm-hmm. so that we can care for him. I mean, as an audience, we need to care for these characters.
Right.
We don't want to dislike the creature.
And but somehow Peter was able to get you past some inhibition or some block that's personal, it sounds like.
Absolutely. And that's just like the physicality. It really comes out of going for it and going for it and not getting it over and over again. And then there's a breakthrough and it just happens. Mm. And it's a relief when it happens.
I found it.
Yes. Right. And then, you hope you can find it the next night and the night after that too.
So are you just, in other words, did you have to come to a way of thinking about it that was different? Did you have to exercise a ghost? What did you have to do? Or did you just keep trying different stuff? Was it outside in, kind of?
Yeah, I would describe it as outside in, in my case, for this. Mm-hmm. It was a matter of going in there and saying, all right, I've got to do this. And if it starts with the vocals, mm-hmm. then it starts with the vocals, mm-hmm. and maybe that will take me somewhere. Mm-hmm. Maybe through that avenue, I can find where I need to be.
Right.
And that's interesting that it sometimes can work that way.
Right.
Externally.
Right.
On its way in.
Right. Well, it's, I think, a really remarkable performance. And maybe for me, the most surprising thing about this interview is learning that you felt that the humanity was hard to find. Because from the audience perspective now, with your performance completely evolved, or at least, I'm sure it's still evolving, but that's the striking thing, is how poignant it is and how moving that creature is. Mm-hmm. Whatever it took you to get there, I'd say you certainly did. And I'm glad that we had a chance to talk about it, and I hope other people will see it.
Oh, me too. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of March 30th, 2009. Victory Gardens Theater has announced their next season, and they're ramping things up with an ambitious 7-play lineup, with one of the company's most daring new play development projects in over 36 years. And it happens to be the next phase of the Ignition Festival. Last spring, 120 new works were submitted by playwrights of color and under 40 years old. 6 finalists were selected, and their productions were workshopped and presented as staged readings in a week-long festival this past summer. Now, 2 world premieres by the young writers will kick off the Victory Gardens 2009-2010 season. Year Zero by Michael Galanko will be the debut production in the Victory Gardens' new 120-seat second-floor studio theater. Next will be The Elaborate Entrance of Chad Deity by Christopher Diaz. This will be a co-production with Teatro Vista. Victory Gardens will also bring back the smash hit holiday musical The Snow Queen for the 4th season. Following that will be the Chicago premiere of Blue Door and the Chicago premiere of The Lost Boys of Sudan. James Sherman's world premiere farce Jacob and Jack can also be seen in the season. And finally, the debut of A Guide for the Perplexed. This one will co-star Kevin Anderson and Francis Guinan. 5, 6, and 7-play subscriptions are now available. For more in-depth details on the Victory Gardens' stellar 2009-2010 season, click on over to Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. 23 members of the American Theater Company's ensemble announced that they are no longer part of the ATC. American Theater Company is Chicago's second oldest ensemble-based company. Those members are forming the American Blues Theater, which was actually originally founded back in 1985 by the same members. The newly reformed organization will present 2 productions in 2010 in celebration of their 25th season as an ensemble. The American Blues Ensemble is saying that there's administrative and artistic differences with the newest artistic director of the ATC, PJ Paparelli. Rick Cleveland, founding member, said that it's going to be more than just a name change. It'll be a revelation. This ensemble of artists began their collaboration back in 1985 with the production Dogman's Last Stand. They then went on to produce such hits as Bad Moon, Keely and Dew, American Buffalo, and of course, Oklahoma. The individuals supporting this departure and forming the new / old ensemble can be found at Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. Steppenwolf Theater Company has announced their 5th annual First Look Festival repertory of new works that can be seen this summer. This year's festival includes the show Honest, Sky Dubai, and Sex with Strangers. Ed Sobel will be curating the festival again. The festival features 3 productions of new plays presented in rotation and accompanied by a series of readings, lectures, and events focused on the development of new work. The Hypocrites Theater has announced some of the titles of their next season. Most surprisingly is that House Theater's Matt Hawkins will be directing Cabaret for the Hypocrites next spring. That's right, Cabaret. Also included in the 13th season will be Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. This one will be adapted and directed by Sean Graney, and that can be seen next fall. Graney will also direct Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit. Stay tuned to Talk Theater in Chicago for more information as the season unfolds. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Kevin Cox for giving us the honor of interviewing him this week. I would also like to thank Ann Nicholson Weber and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.